Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
All right, hello everyone, and welcome to the show. I'm your host, Daniel Stone, and I am thrilled to have this guest on today. We're talking with Dr. James Bratt, and he wrote this great book with Dr. John F. Wolverton called A Christian and a Democrat, A Religious Biography of Franklin D. Roosevelt. It's published by Erdmann's Books. It's part of their fantastic religious biography series. And Jim, thanks so much for being on the show. We really appreciate
it. Well, I'm delighted to be with you. So I really enjoyed working on this project, and I'm glad to let people know about it.
Oh, thanks, Jim. Yeah, I just got to say, the book is phenomenal. I really enjoyed reading it. And I mean, most people who love history, I mean, first of all, FDR, it's a name that we're all familiar with, mostly because of the Great Depression and World War II. He's a monumental figure within American history. And this is the first religious biography on him. Am I correct on that?
Well, there have been some others, more journalistic memoirs, more journalistic impressions. So I think it's safe to say this is the first full-scale scholarly religious biography of FDR. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, very eye-opening. So, Jim, you know, just before we jump into the book, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, like, you know, where you went to school, your research interests, and how did you get involved with this project?
Okay, yeah. Well, I got my PhD at Yale University more years ago than I like to acknowledge. But I worked with, one of the great religious historians, certainly of his generation, really of all time, Sidney Ahlstrom, who was very eclectic in his interests, very interested in getting all the parts of the American religious story out there. And so I secondarily worked with David Brian Davis, who was probably the premier historian of American slavery at the time. So I have an interest in religion. I've always had a strong interest in religion, but not so much the theology or the teachings or the rituals just in themselves, but also how this gets outside the church or the temple or the mosque walls and gets into everyday life. So church and society, church and religion and society, religion and culture, and particularly religion and politics. That's been a real long-standing interest of mine. So when I heard about, through a mutual friend, I've never met John Wolverton, unfortunately, but when he passed away, a mutual acquaintance passed along a short tribute, an obit that he had written for Professor Wolverton. And I read in there that John Wolverton had completed this huge biography, religious biography of Franklin Roosevelt, and it remained unpublished and slightly unfinished at his death. And I thought, geez, that's a shame. And I just retired from my long-standing job, my professorship. I thought that would be a really cool project to get into. And also, frankly, because religion and politics today is unfortunately totally associated with the religious right. And it can have a really obnoxious, in my view, an obnoxious agenda and a very bad tone. And I just wanted to recover and put out a story that shows that religious involvement in American politics in the past has also been much more positive and much more progressive. And this biography is tailor-made for that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's beautifully written, and it really does it. I agree with you. It's so partisan today and politically charged. And this book was very refreshing just to kind of read because I will jump into that. But you had talked about, you know, how, you know, there's this argument within American religion of like civic religion, especially within the 20th century. And, you know, you and John, you guys kind of push against that. We're saying FDR wasn't necessarily a civic religion, but it was almost like a quiet religion that he had, or a more personal religion that he would bring out within his public life. And I really appreciated that. It brings a whole new light to American history.
Yeah. We make a point that FDR was not a real proponent, or he was not a deep believer in what's called American civil religion, which makes the nation the highest object of reverence and makes its rituals, the patriotic rituals, the real essence of religion. FDR had a genuine, fairly liberal kind of Christian religion. And what I found really encouraging is that there was a lot of interface between that genuine religious tradition and public service, the public sphere. So it's a genuine religion, in this case, Christian. It could be Jewish, it could be Buddhist, it could be Muslim, whatever. A genuine religion with a strong civic component, with a strong sense of public responsibility. We got to get, for FDR, particularly the ethics of Christianity outside the church walls and into the larger society. And that is essentially, that's the message or the thesis of this book, that a lot of what we recognize as the New Deal is a translation from FDR's kind of Episcopal social gospel upbringing into the heart and soul of American life.
Very nice. Very nice. Absolutely. So I had another question, just so the readers know, the foreword's by James Comey. And how did you get James Comey to write, the former FBI director? How did you guys get him to write the foreword for this book?
Well, I didn't, but John Wolverton's son, Arthur, did. As it turns out, John Wolverton was a guest professor at William & Mary for a year. And William & Mary at that time was where James Comey was a college student. And Comey signed up for Wolverton's course on kind of modern Christian thinkers or modern theologians. And one of the figures covered in there, and indeed deserved to be, is Reinhold Niebuhr. And both for his public philosophy, for his philosophy of service, and also out of some personal crisis, James in his life, his recent life, James Comey found Reinhold Niebuhr really very, very helpful, and he was always grateful to Professor Wolverton for introducing that. The two became friends. They stayed in touch. And when John Wolverton passed away a few years ago, then I think Director Comey said to the family that I owe so much to your father. If I ever can do anything to promote his memory or whatever, let me know. And so when this book's ready to come out, they said, well, how about the son contacted him and said, how about a foreword? And he said, done and done. And it came in, and it's a very effective piece of writing, very, very poignant, how Comey remembers Wolverton and why Comey thinks this book is important.
Oh, terrific. All right. So I have a question. Why was John Wolverton, and why were you so interested in FDR? And I guess more importantly, why were you interested in FDR's religion? Because it seems that, like you had said, there was some journalistic impressions of FDR's religion, but for the most part, there really hasn't been this comprehensive examination of it. And you guys really kind of dive into it. Yeah. So what drew you to FDR?
Well, I think we have to talk, first of all, about Professor Wolverton's side in it, because he did the writing. I did the editing. I added one short chapter, but this is really Professor Wolverton's book with my editorial work to get it ready to go to press. Well, John Wolverton is followed in many of the same pathways as Roosevelt did. Wolverton was an Episcopalian. He went to Groton as FDR did for prep school, for high school. He went to Harvard as FDR did. His wife, Professor Wolverton's wife, attended Eleanor Roosevelt School. And Frances Perkins, who has a pretty important role in this book, in this whole story, she was the Secretary of Labor, and she got ready a lot of the critical New Deal legislation. Frances Perkins was a friend of the Wolverton family, so there's a really strong personal connection there. So as a historian of the Episcopal Church, John Wolverton thought that FDR was one of the neglected subjects in that whole domain, and he resolved to do something about that. I got interested in it, as I said, because I think we need some to recover some examples or discover examples of religion playing a much more progressive role in American politics than has recently been the case. So I have I have an advocacy interest in this. Now, as to your other question of why FDR's religion has not been investigated so much, FDR had a well-earned reputation of being a very, very able politician, and really able to get down in the dust and fight hard political fights. And our notion is that that can't be, that doesn't associate with religion, right? Because religion is about high ideals, it's about nice people, it's about noble goals, blah, blah, blah. And that doesn't go with politics. Also, FDR never talked that much in public about his religion. He really disliked to have reporters observing him when he would go to church and be at his prayers. So he had a very strong, very deep personal sense, a private sense of kind of the sacred part of him that he didn't want newspaper people to be looking in at. And he thought it was pretty crass when people would angle for votes on an overtly religious basis. So, for instance, one of his mentors, Al Smith, ran for president in 1928 on the Democratic ticket. Al Smith was the first Roman Catholic, well, not the first, but he was the second Roman Catholic to run for the presidency. And the Republican opposition made a great big deal of that. And indeed, it cost Smith a good number of votes. FDR really resented that. So he was scared, averse to making religion something to fight about or fight with. And yet it was a deep part of his personal core. So part of the project of this book was to show how this deeply personal inner core got carried over into very nitty-gritty political action.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. And so what I found interesting was how John and you got into the religious mind of FDR. Could you explain for us a little bit, how did you guys do that? And really, I guess what I'm asking is, you know, because he was so private, what historical sources did you use to kind of look at FDR's religion?
Yeah, well, there are some key speeches where FDR became very explicit about religion. Well, let me back up a minute. First of all, when he would take the oath of office twice as governor of New York, four times as president of the United States, he had the old family Bible, which came over in the ship from the Netherlands. So it's the Staten Bible. the official Dutch translation from the 17th century. He would be sworn in on that, and he always had it open to Paul's letter to first letter to the Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 13. And that's one of the most memorable parts of St. Paul's writings, of course, a very famous passage. And Paul, concludes that chapter by saying, now there abide these three things, faith, hope, and love, and the greatest of these is love. And Roosevelt, FDR, quite often referred to that triad, the faith, hope, and love, as the kind of the core of the Christian gospel. And at the same time, kind of the core of human decency, the core of what should mark, the key markers of what would be a decent society, what a society should aspire to. So he's calling this up again and again. Roosevelt also called up Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, key elements of that again and again. So this is kind of the stuff that's always running through Roosevelt. Then there are some key moments where he, in a State of the Union message or important addresses, he gets very explicit about religion, again, refers to 1 Corinthians 13. Professor Wolverton includes in this book, for the first time, kind of the edited copy of FDR's famous prayer at D-Day. So when the D-Day invasion was occurring, Roosevelt went on the radio that night, which was the way that, you know, presidents communicated to everybody at that point, and he read this prayer. And you can, Professor Wolverton recovered the original text and then looked at FDR's edits. And we have this in this book, a black line edit, where he inserted some things, took away other things. And you realize what a very, very good wordsmith FDR was. Every time he makes a change, the image is more memorable, the verb is stronger. He was really a genius with words. So, then there's one other dimension that was crucial to the book, and that is to look at Roosevelt's formation. He was a lifelong member of St. James Episcopal Church in Hyde Park. His father, James Roosevelt, served on the vestry there, the governing board, for decades, and FDR himself was on the vestry for decades. While he was president, in fact, he would be a part of his day every once in a while would be devoted to stuff that happening at his home church. So he had a living connection with a particular congregation. Beside that, Professor Wolverton looked at who his tutor was, this French woman who was FDR's tutor when he was being kind of homeschooled, we would say, at Hyde Park. And then especially at his formation at Groton School, where he went for late middle school and high school, and under the leadership of Endicott Peabody, who was a very strong, intimidating, loving, tough love kind of guy. He was kind of the most eminent prep school headmaster, maybe in American history. I mean, Endicott Peabody kind of set the gold standard. And Endicott Peabody was very, very serious and very effective at suffusing the education at Groton with progressive Christian ideals, not just in not so much in theology, but in giving these young men a sense of purpose and a sense of obligation. Endicott Peabody said to this, I mean, it's the emerging ruling class of the Gilded Age, right? And he said essentially to them, every day, every year, every month of every year, you guys have great privilege, and with that comes great responsibility. And here's how you do that. So Professor Wolverton dug very deeply into Roosevelt's educational formation, we would say, and how this comes through, kind of set them on the course that would come through ultimately in the New Deal.
Great. Well, I guess that kind of brings me to my next question is, what did FDR's Christianity look like? Just kind of like a quick overview. And you did touch on how he formed his Christianity, which was fascinating. Could you just kind of give us a brief overview of that? Because I know it's mostly in the book, so we want people to read it. But FDR's Christianity, really, it really struck me how influential it was, not only for his personal life, but how it also affected his actions for the country.
Yeah. Well, picking up from that theme I just mentioned about with privilege and power come responsibility. There was a, I don't think that Roosevelt had this professor at Harvard, but one of the great professors at Harvard, great philosophers, was Josiah Royce, who kind of popularized the theme of the beloved community, that the good life is one in which we take part, and our deepest hearts yearning are to take part in a community of sharing, a community of loyalty, of obligation, and of great love. Not touchy-feely, sentimental love, but love measured by serving and helping and having high regard for our neighbor. And I think that's the crux of Franklin Roosevelt's religion. He was part of the aristocracy of the Hudson River.
Yeah.
And his father modeled that. His father took all this noblesse oblige roles in the local community. He knew that he had been put in a privileged and powerful position. And he knew that the measure of how well he did in that was not whether he got more money like the neighboring Vanderbilts, but whether he made his community a happier, more integrated place where people took care of each other. And Franklin Roosevelt, and this is where he ran into some difficulties too, Franklin Roosevelt dreamed of the United States as that kind of local community where neighbors really looked out for each other, carried each other in affection. And translating that into policy was what the New Deal was about, the Civilian Conservation Corps, where you're caring for the earth as well as giving mostly young men, but thousands and thousands of young men who are otherwise destitute, giving them a job, not just to keep them off the streets, but to give them dignity and give them hope and give them a sense of purpose. Also, Social Security, which Francis Perkins essentially wrote up, that people, one of the greatest groups in poverty in the United States in the 1920s was elderly people. And FDR said, we got to turn that around. People who've worked their whole life here should have a basic foundation on which they can rely financially. And that has worked as intended. Also, recognition of labor unions, another key part of the FDR or of the New Deal. Corporate business has a whole lot of collective power. Workers should have kind of a comparable concentration of power. So, Roosevelt was no sentimentalist. He knew that people respond to force and to power. And so, labor unions would give the workers a voice, and that would also, again, increase their solidarity and their sense of dignity and of self-regard. So it's a frequent mistake to think that the New Deal was just throwing money at people, lazy people, or just to keep them out of trouble or whatever. FDR really hated handouts. What he wanted was what we would call investment in human and social capital. The GI Bill is another expression of this. So you give people a sense of hope. You give them the talent. You invest in them to give them the skills so that they can realize the human potential in them. Roosevelt had a strong sense of innate human dignity and possibility. And things go wrong in society, he thought, when this is quashed or this is not realized. So his programs aimed at activating these better parts of people so that they could take a full participation in American society. He thought that that's what democracy really was, not just voting once every 2 or 4 years, but being a full participant with your fellow citizens, with your equals, in making a better life for everybody.
Yeah, it's fascinating stuff because it seems that FDR had this social gospel mindset in a way where I know, you know, the social gospel was late 19th, early 20th century, but FDR is kind of carrying it on forwards in the mid 20th century. And you did touch on, and you and John did touch on that in the book, but would you agree with that? I mean, that he had this very social, it sounds like you're saying he had this very social gospel mentality. And he just kind of implemented that within, you know, civic society.
Right. Yeah. So the social gospel really got going, in the 1880s, 1890s, and really inspired a lot of the people who were involved, at least the white Protestant and some African-American Protestant people as well, who were involved in the Progressive Era. That's where so the Gilded Age and the Progressive Era is where Roosevelt had his education, first of all, and then his first forays into politics. He was Undersecretary of the Navy, for instance, for Woodrow Wilson, who was one of the great progressive presidents. The other great progressive president, of course, was FDR's distant cousin, Theodore. Or distant uncle, Theodore Roosevelt. With World War One and then the collapse of idealism after World War One and the make a lot of money mood of the 1920s, it seemed that the social gospel was dead. But Roosevelt brought it back for a new era in American politics. He said this is not dead. This just has to be translated into terms of a mass industrial society. And so the social insurance, recognition of labor unions and so forth, all this had been part of the social gospel, and a lot of it had been part of the Progressive Era aims. And Roosevelt was an extremely able politician, and he made it happen. And for that matter, the times were meant for him too, because after the stock market crash and then the entry of the descent of the United States and the rest of the Atlantic world into the Great Depression, there certainly was a need for these old progressive programs again, now adapted to to the mid 20th century, as you said.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. So when we think about FDR too, we often think about him, you know, and his polio and him being in a wheelchair. And I could imagine, and you guys do touch on this in the book, how is his religion affected by his disease? And I guess vice versa, how did his disease affect his religion? Because that was one of the biggest questions I had when picking up this book, was that you could just imagine just this, it almost seems like an insurmountable feat that he has to overcome to this disease, but he does do it and he achieves great things. And you bring out and John brings out this idea that, you know, that that was a major impact on his life with his religion as well.
Yeah, well, we never wish catastrophes like this on anybody. But in retrospect, this in a way was the making. This polio, this paralysis, I hate to say this because this can be misinterpreted, but it was one of the better things that ever happened to Roosevelt. Because before this, he had been kind of a callow playboy type. He was a fair-haired boy. He was very popular with the elites. People found him possibly too flippant. We would say feeling too entitled. And this onset of paralysis was really, in religious terms, FDR's descent into the depths. This was his descent into hell. And this really made him come to terms with the issues of life. This got him over his sense of entitlement. This said, life is serious. And if you're going to be anything, you're worthwhile. You're going to have to fight to be that. So it made him, I would say, a deeper and richer and more serious person. Now, please don't go out and the next time you see someone struggling, say, oh, you know, God has a wonderful plan for your life and this is be the good best thing that can ever happen to you. This is for the sufferer, him or herself, to discover, okay? But in any case, in Roosevelt's case, he did discover it. And the other thing he discovered, this limited his mobility in many ways, but also in a certain sense, it increased his mobility because he, for therapy, he went down and he founded this hospital, this full care facility at Warm Springs. It was the best place to be treated for paralysis in the United States at the time. He put over half of his own considerable personal fortune into this. Some people thought it was a fool's errand. But anyway, down there, he met a much richer mix of people than he would have met, you know, just hanging around with his Groton and Harvard and Hyde Park, Hudson Valley elite buddies. And he also had custom made this automobile that he could drive around the back roads of Georgia and the back roads around Hyde Park. And so he loved to get out of the pool, and he loved to get out of the confines of Warm Springs. So he would putt around the Georgia countryside in this customized automobile with handbrakes and everything. And he'd see, a poor cotton farmer, dirt farmer, working around with a mule and a plow. And he'd call them over, and they would chat. And Roosevelt here confronted poverty and but amid that great human dignity as he never otherwise had or would have. So getting deep within himself and reaching out to a vast new way to ordinary people, this is what that paralysis did for him. It summoned up sources, this crisis, as very often happens in history, right? We get profound religious conversions, profound new sense of purpose out of a crisis or a catastrophe. I think this was the in many ways, the making of the ultimately successful FDR.
Yeah, I like how you said that, how you mentioned the word catastrophe, because it just seems that, you know, FDR's tenure as president, I mean, two catastrophic events for the United States, the Great Depression and World War II. I mean, these are just monumental, catastrophes for the country. And yet here he is kind of at the wheel. And he's kind of leading the country forward. But I thought also, I kind of got that sense that, you know, because he had the polio, it really helped him empathize with average Americans who were suffering during the Great Depression. And that also seemed to really influence his religion and how he kind of, guided, you know, the country with the New Deal and all these social programs to kind of get people back on their feet, as you were mentioning.
Yeah, he, he was a brilliant communicator using the then relatively new technology of mass distribution radio, broadcasting. Radio had kind of been a little hobby for a lot of the 20s, and it had become a very powerful public medium for the first time really in the 30s. And all the great leaders of the day, for better, I think of Roosevelt and Churchill, and also for worse, Hitler and Mussolini, were masters of this medium. And there are a countless number of people who said that when they sat down and listened, gathered around the big radio in the living room to listen to one of FDR's fireside chats, it felt like he was just speaking to them directly, personally. So, you're right. This gave him great empathy. And John Wolverton, says in this book that FDR knew what to do about paralysis. personally, and therefore he could speak very effectively to a whole nation in paralysis. I mean, in 1933, early 33, when he's inaugurated, the whole country, the whole economy has seized up, right? One of my grandfathers, for instance, he was just a pushcart carpenter in Holland, Michigan. He lost all his money in the bank because the bank that he had, put week by week, a little pittance of savings, and it went belly up and that money was gone. So Roosevelt communicated to a whole society in a very personal way out of his own personal experience of paralysis. And he, it's really striking when you look at his first inaugural address. And this is so relevant to today. In 1933, America really was amid carnage, right? It was in destruction mode or destroyed mode. And Roosevelt came out and said, he gave a message of hope. Overriding everything else was hope. And the great villain on the scene, he said, was fear. And the only thing we have to fear, he said most memorably, is fear itself. So in the depths of this real American carnage, to come out with this very plausible voice of hope was, I think it might have been the saving of the nation, because there were plenty of would-be demagogues like Mussolini around in the United States at that time. And if the leader had appealed to people's baser nature, who knows what might have happened. So Roosevelt was, I think this nation was very fortunate to have someone who believed in, faith, hope, and charity, St. Paul's trilogy or triad, and to communicate that effectively and to keep that constantly in people's view and to push through policies that tried to fulfill those values.
Oh, wow. Yeah, for sure. I love what you're talking about, Jim, because you're giving us a whole new perspective on FDR that we don't often see in the history books. So it's really fascinating stuff. And, as we all know, after the Great Depression, we enter World War II, and that's kind of what brings the United States out of the Great Depression. And as you mentioned, with Mussolini and Hitler, the world was changing drastically, and now the world is at war. So how does FDR switch gears from, the Great Depression to World War II, and how is his religion affecting his decisions for the war?
Yeah, here you get into more controversial ethical area, because World War II was a total war. For the first time, at least in modern wars, by far most of the casualties of war were civilian. Some of the weapons that the United States used with the mass bombing, not to mention the atomic bombing, these were mostly inflicted on civilians, which violates the traditional code of just war. So here we get into ethically more challenging territory. What FDR said, however, was that, he said this is a war to save the future of democracy. People that we fight with or that we're allied with, like the Soviet Union, FDR had no illusions about what was going on in Stalin's Russia. But he said, Stalin and Russia are not a threat to the United States. Nazi Germany is a direct threat. And the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so he extended himself to keep the Soviet Union in the war. Massive American material aid to Russia and the Red Army. So he said that let me refer to the book's title, right? A Christian and a Democrat. That was FDR's thumbnail description of what his political philosophy was. So Francis Perkins had told this story in the first place, and John Wolverton picked up on it at one of his zillion press conferences. A reporter asks Roosevelt right off the top of his head, President Roosevelt, what is your political philosophy? And Roosevelt was not a philosopher, right? And he was kind of flabbergasted, flummoxed for a minute. And he said, why? I'm a Christian and a Democrat, and that's it. Not just a big D Democrat, but also a small D Democrat. He thought that democracy as a system was the political system that gave people most dignity, that accorded them dignity, that recognized their potential, and gave them a possibility for realizing their, what was for him, Roosevelt, God-given potential. And the way to do that is to love your neighbor. And you love your neighbor best when you recognize that we're all equals under the skin. So that was what the New Deal was about. And that, for him, was what World War II was about. He knew that there was a lot of suffering and death that was going to happen here. He consulted his prayer book every night before he would go to sleep. You know, prayer book was lying right next to his on his nightstand. And go back and have a talk with him and get him to be frank. And Roosevelt was notoriously not candid with when people came pestering him for this or that. But if I could get him down and candid, I would say, you're fighting for a great ideal here and you're using some pretty terrible methods. How does that sit with you? And I think that must have had some kind of deep deepening in him. What he did we say in the book, he kind of functioned in his wartime addresses and his radio talks. He kind of functioned as kind of a pastor for the nation, saying that we're suffering a lot and a lot of terrible things are going on in the world, but we keep hope alive. And to borrow something from the classic civil rights movement, we keep our eye on the prize. Okay, so we don't get overexcited. We don't say that this war is going to be over in a year. We have to be sober. We have to be disciplined. We have to not hate our enemies. He said that again and again and again. We have to not hate our enemies, or we have become like our enemies. So he's kind of a perennial pastor to the nation, calming people down and encouraging them for the long run, because he knew that this war was going to take a long time.
Hmm. Yeah. Interesting stuff. Thanks, Jim. And another part of the book that I find as a real gem, it's the last chapter, and it's this comparison of FDR to Lincoln and to Hoover. And it's just a great chapter. And I just thought, of course, I want people to buy the book and to read it, but could you just kind of give us a brief overview? Why did John and you decide to kind of have that as the last chapter, this comparison between the three of them?
Yeah, well, this is entirely John. When I got this manuscript from the family, I was reading through it, this and that. Yeah, okay. And then there's this last chapter. I said, what the heck is this? Because it's not part of the chronology, but it does give a great, by comparison, by drawing these comparisons, you get a better sense than ever of what Roosevelt was all about, particularly how his religion came through. So the comparison to Hoover, first of all, because Hoover was his immediate predecessor, and Roosevelt and Hoover are always compared as antithetical, right? The Republican and the Democrat, the failure and the success, the free market and the planned economy, blah, blah, blah. But John Wolverton points out in introducing Hoover how much Hoover and Roosevelt shared back in the teens and the early 20s. Herbert Hoover was an amazingly accomplished and effective, successful, progressive administrator during World War I. He saved millions of lives in Europe by organizing food relief. But then something happens, or there's something different about Hoover. And John and I got down into Hoover's Quaker religion and what that instilled in a person as a set of ideals. And it was kind of a distrust of politics, a very strong emphasis upon the inner sacredness of the individual can translate, and did in Hoover's case, into a philosophy of individualism, and a real sense that the worst thing in the world is sloth or laziness. With Roosevelt, the worst of the seven deadly sins is greed or avarice. And that comes out of his, Roosevelt's, Episcopalian social gospel background. So without overdetermining things here, I think John and I have uncovered another dimension, another layer to the explanation of how these two one-time similar progressives took such different responses or different avenues in addressing the Great Depression. There's something about Hoover's kind of Midwest Quakerism and something about Roosevelt's kind of Hudson Valley elite Episcopalianism that translated out of church into politics in very different ways. Now, comparison to Lincoln, well, Lincoln's one of the typically, Washington, Lincoln, and FDR are rated as the top three American presidents. Certainly, all three of them are in the top five of anybody's measure of successful American presidencies. Well, you don't want to compare FDR to Washington because he's kind of the saint, right? Way back there. And Lincoln is in a society that's more resembles Roosevelt, certainly, than Washington's did. So compare it was a pretty gutsy call on John's part to compare FDR to this great saint, Abraham Lincoln. And there we're looking at Lincoln's own religion, which is not, strictly speaking, Christian. It's deeply biblical. But Lincoln had nothing much to say about and no particular relationship to or regard for Jesus Christ as a particular figure. And, you know, making a lot of Jesus is pretty important to Christianity, yeah? So Lincoln is more like a classic Unitarian. He certainly was not an atheist. He had a skeptical episode or period in his earlier life. But by the time he's president, Lincoln sees as something is going on here that's way beyond anybody's power to set up or to control. I thought I was going to drive history, he said famously, and it turns out history's driving me. And there, Lincoln, in the depths of the Civil War, which is, you know, exacted more casualties than all American wars, other American wars put together, Lincoln is presiding over this carnage, and he's a deeply meditative person. And he, Lincoln, goes back to his father, Thomas Lincoln's so-called hard-shell Baptist background. Thomas Lincoln was a kind of a lay preacher, and this was double predestinarian Calvinism of a particularly hard sort. Lincoln, Abraham, that is, had rejected that earlier in his life, but now a more benign version of that comes back in Lincoln. And so in his famous second inaugural address, you know, both sides read the same Bible, pray to the same God, both invoke their God's aid against the other. The prayers of both could not be answered. The prayers of neither have been answered. The Almighty has his own purposes. So that kind of Calvinistically inflected sense of destiny, a very hard-bitten, somewhat dark theology on Lincoln's part. Well, FDR, after Lincoln, FDR is the president that has faced the equivalent crisis to Lincoln's, to the Civil War. And it's so striking that FDR's is a very sunny outlook, an emphasis upon human freedom, not upon this kind of predestination, an emphasis upon human goodness, not upon the grimmer side of human nature. So Lincoln and FDR both rose to their occasions. So we don't have, as in Hoover, failure versus success. Here we have, if you will, two success stories, but coming out of very different theological convictions. So these were, in drawing these contrasts, I think we understand more about Roosevelt, what a peculiar and particular kind of combination he is. And also we get more light, I think, on Lincoln and on Hoover.
Yeah. Jim, this is a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much. And I just want to reiterate, we're talking with James Bratt about A Christian and a Democrat, a religious biography of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It's part of Erdman's religious biography series. Once again, it's a fantastic book. And Jim, I just wanted to say thank you so much for elaborating to us about this terrific book. And before I let you go, what are you working on now, and what can we expect to learn from you in the future?
Well, I have two projects that I want to get done. The one is, I think it would be pretty controversial, and I'll just give you my working title. I'm not sure I'm going to write this book, but this is the one I kind of wonder whether I should write. The title would be, Is Donald Trump the Antichrist? And Other Essays in How American Evangelicalism Became So Unchristian. just to put the cards right on the table there. I don't think that American evangelicalism has always been, in fact, many times in the past, American history has had a very positive political expression. And boy, something has happened. Something has happened. So to figure out what has gone on in white American evangelicalism is one thing I'm interested in. That would be, as you can tell, a very polemical book. And by the way, no, I don't think that Donald Trump is the Antichrist. I think the whole way, what I would do in this, the first essay in this book, we have to just get away from this whole fundamentalist approach to history as trying to figure out when the end times are and who's the Antichrist and the mark of the beast and all this stuff. I don't think is a very helpful way of understanding our times. Again, I'm much more interested in St. Paul here, who said memorably that our struggle is not with flesh and blood, but with the principalities and the powers. In academic parlance today, we say the hegemonic powers, the hegemonic mentalities, the things that have us in thrall, like guns and war and race and so forth. These are the things we have to struggle with, and looking for antichrists is not helpful at all. Anyway, so that's the sharp-edged polemical book that I may or may not write. And I'll have a gentle listener, please let me know whether you think I should do this or not. the other one is analysis of going back before the Civil War. There a remarkable conjunction right in the early 1840s of a spiritual crisis, a profound religious crisis in the lives of 20 some people that become, that kind of set the tone for American religion for the next generation or so. And the working notion there is what happens when the Second Great Awakening dies. American historians have given a lot of attention. We American historians generally traditionally like to tell success stories, how new good things rise, but fewer people talk about what makes them falter and what replaces them. So when the fires of the burned over district, when the fires of revivalism die out in the early 1840s, what replaces them? And this is a real question for, 18, 20 different people. And so this would be kind of a collective biography to explore a profound moment of religious change.
Wow. Both of those books sound fantastic. So I hope you get a chance to write those. I would personally like to read them both.
Well, why don't you write one of them for me so I don't have to?
All right, I choose the second one because the first one sounds way too polemical for my taste.
I get that. And the better angel of my nature has me going for the second one too. But sometimes just watching the news, I get too agitated.
No, I totally understand. I agree with you. It's very partisan. And no, all joking aside, it's a very valid topic that really does need to be teased out. Regardless of what we think of the Trump administration, I always joke with my colleagues. I always say, regardless of what we think about Trump or everything that's going on, I said, I can just guarantee one thing. The history books are going to be so good. they're basically going to write themselves.
Yeah. Well, there will be, I think the partisanship will continue.
Well, Jim, thanks so much for being on. Really appreciate it. And thanks so much for, enlightening us on FDR's religious mind. Again, it's a really wonderful topic and an unexplored topic until now. So thank you again.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure for me to talk about this good project. And I hope that people will pick it up and be informed and maybe inspired.
Absolutely. All right. Take care.
Okay. You too. Thanks, Daniel.